Whether you drive a car, need a car, or just occasionally bum a ride with friends, you've come to the right place.
Join the editors of Consumer Guide Automotive as they break down everything that's going on in the auto world.
New car reviews.
Shopping tips.
Driving green.
Electric cars.
Classic cars.
And plenty of great guests.
This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
Here's your host, Tom Appel.
All right, this is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast, and I am Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Hey, thanks for joining us today. Please check us out at consumerguide.com. Be sure to check out our 2021 Best Buy Picks. This list is an excellent starting place if you are looking for a new car or crossover. You will also want to check out our blog for complete reviews of all the vehicles we're driving here at Consumer Guide and all sorts of other fun auto-related stuff. And if you've missed an episode or two of the podcast, you can stream back episodes of the Car Stuff Podcast right there on our homepage. If you have questions or comments, drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com. That is carstuff@consumerguide.com. And hey, due to a scheduling error, we ran a previous episode last week on WCPT. If you'd like to hear the show that should have aired, look for episode 68 anywhere that you download podcasts. We'd hate for you to have missed it. All right, let's see who's online with us today. She is the managing editor of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk, and her freelance work can be found all over the internet. She's Jill Simonillo. Hey, Jill.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good. I am done. I shouldn't say done because I feel like I'm not going to be done for a while, but I am sick of shoveling. That is
Amen.
What I want to say to you today.
Amen to that.
I don't know about either of you guys, but I spent probably 2 or 3 hours on, was it Tuesday we got completely dumped on, digging my husband out of our alley because he thought it would be a good idea to try and take his car someplace.
In the aftermath of all the snow and cold we've had in the last couple of weeks, I was sort of stunned that there was snow this morning, and it actually messed up my commute a little. I thought we were done.
No, we are not done. And I just, like, I want it all to go away. Is it May yet? Please.
So Jill, little side note before we bring Damon on, I just want to share something I saw on TV. Just a quick note. Actually, saw on TV and heard on the radio. I saw a commercial for the Ford Fusion.
Okay.
I thought that car was just dead. I mean, I know they're still pushing them into fleets, and I guess there's some on dealer lots, but there was a commercial for the Fusion that is Ford's midsize sedan. I thought that was gone. I'm surprised they're still advertising it. Secondly,
did you see it as a rerun?
No. Yeah. Do they rerun commercials?
I don't know.
That seems like bad business.
I don't know.
I heard a radio ad for the new Ford Explorer. It was a local dealer ad talking about the new less expensive Explorer. And that's a quote, the less expensive Explorer. I know they lowered prices a little bit, but I'm surprised that that's actually part of a campaign now.
Well, when the average transaction price of a car is $40,000, maybe it's time to start talking about the lower prices because people are spending a lot of money on cars.
I'm just surprised because the Explorer sold just fine. I don't think it set the world on fire, but it wasn't like it was a sales dog. So we could talk about that stuff later. Right now, he's the senior editor here at Consumer Guide, and he runs a business on the side called Second Chance Fresh, which reconditions pine tree air fresheners. Welcome to the show, Damon Bell.
Sorry, I had to jump the gun a little bit there because I needed to give an amen to the
the snow shoveling.
Snow shoveling venti because I've done more than my share. I have to give props to my California native wife, though, because she knows how to wield a snow shovel. And we've both had to do that a lot this past week. And my particular suburb, I saw some Chicagoland area map. And surprise, surprise, my suburb got the most snowfall of the entire area. It was something like 18.6 inches over the last few days. So it's been miserable, and we're running out of places to put the snow. But I guess in terms of weather woes, we're doing better than Texas.
That would be true.
We all still have power and stuff. So, yeah. But I need to go snowblower shopping, bottom line.
we've had a couple of nice winters where it's like, we didn't need the snowblower,
exactly.
And then all of a sudden, dumped on.
Yep. Chicago weatherman Ed Curran, who is a friend of ours in the media, posted a map during this disaster, and I think right before the last most recent storm, and his caption read something along the lines of redefining lake effect.
For people
not in the Chicagoland area, they may not know about lake effect snow, but the lake has a huge impact on our weather, right. And often if you live within a mile or so of the lake, you get very strange weather patterns that are inconsistent with the rest of the Chicagoland area. But in this case, it was as far inland as your place, Damon, but not as far as mine. I got very little snow this last wave. You got a bunch.
Right.
The
whole lake effect thing is interesting because I have a friend in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and he's like, all-wheel drive is an essential thing to have because of they're obviously on the opposite side of Lake Michigan, but that eastern end apparently gets a lot more lake effect snow than Chicago typically does.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, enough about the weather, kids. Jill.
Yes.
We had recently had a conversation about Mitsubishi, and Mitsubishi had made some public news about pulling out of some large markets, one of them Western Europe. And we had thought, and I had predicted, that we wouldn't see 2022 Mitsubishis in the U.S., but I was wrong. Tell us about that.
Tell us about you being wrong?
Yes.
So, this week, Mitsubishi actually launched a 2022 Outlander. And I mean, first off, they did it interestingly because they did it on an Amazon Live reveal event. And second, you know, this is a completely new vehicle, completely redesigned. They're saying that the U.S. starting price is going to be around $26,000. I think it's $25,795. And this will come to the market in April. But the most interesting thing, I think, about this is the fact that it is sharing a platform with the all-new Nissan Rogue.
Yeah. it's funny, and we've talked before on the show about automakers teaming up, particularly in the realm of sports cars, which are a lower volume segment. We've talked about how the BMW Z4 and Toyota Supra share components, but the Subaru BRZ and Toyota 86, but much more interesting to have it happen in one of the biggest biggest sales segments in the American market, compact SUVs. Mm-hmm. So, the underpinnings of this redesign for 2022 Outlander, it's basically a Nissan Rogue underneath, but it certainly has that radical, some might say too radical, Mitsubishi styling. And the other thing I think is interesting that helps set the Outlander apart versus the Rogue is that this is one of the few, almost one of only two vehicles in the mainstream compact SUV class in which you can get a third row seat. And I believe it's standard. It's obviously not going to be a spacious third row seat. You probably can't do if you've got kids over six. That's probably not going to be very comfortable back there. But at least it's there, and you have the flexibility of a third row seat for short trips.
So I'm hearing you say that this might not even be a me-sized third row. Because I'm like the size of a 10-year-old, so I might not even be able to fit back there.
Not for long trips anyway. In a pinch, maybe. And that's how I sort of view these third row seats in smaller cars. Don't expect to take a cross-country road trip and pile six people, even if, you know, three of them or two of them are kids. It's just for, you got the kids at soccer practice, you just need to take the neighbor kids, 3 miles home to from practice, and it just enables that kind of short trip flexibility, and even though it's not as it's not as flexible as a big third row seat, it's nice to have that capability for short trips when you need it, and it's within a smaller vehicle that's much easier to manage day-to-day driving, parking in parking lots, and it's more efficient as well, just given the smaller size.
So I have a question for you guys. The Nissan Rogue is a Consumer Guide Best Buy for 2021. Obviously, the Outlander is based on good bones. That's the good news. Here's my question for you guys. If you have been in a Honda CR-V, a Toyota RAV4, or say a Chevy Equinox for a few years now, and you're looking to replace that car, is Mitsubishi on your map?
No.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can answer that quickly. I don't think Mitsubishi's on anybody's map. And I mean, I will say sometimes it's kind of unfortunate because they do put out a decent product for the money. And I don't know if you've looked at the photos of this new Outlander, but the interior looks pretty amazing.
Yeah. Distinctive.
Very distinctive. Like that black and orange interior, I guess maybe not orange, maybe it's supposed to be tan, but it looks orange.
I think it's orange. Yeah.
So the black and orange interior specifically is a standout. And with the stitching and the I don't know. So but no, I don't I to and the short answer is no. I don't think it's on the radar. But I think that potentially it should be.
There is a thing that happened in the last 10, 15 years to the auto industry, and specifically to American dealerships, and that's that the manufacturers have pressed dealerships to rebuild their stores, go with commonality, you know, common look and feel, big open area architecture, standalone stores for standalone brands, things like that. And there's a Mazda dealer that went up near my house. It looks like the Taj Mahal, for example. And it's very big and it's very inviting. And I don't think that Mitsubishi dealers, and I just checked, which are selling an average of 19 cars a month, are really ready to get a family in the store that's going to bring two kids and they're going to be there to cross shop this thing against a Toyota RAV4 or something. I'm not really sure those stores have the look and feel, the big bright airiness that gives you a good feeling about what you're buying or where you're buying it at. And I'm wondering if Mitsubishi has backed away so far from mainstream marketing that they may not be able to come back.
It's a tough question. I think this Outlander is certainly a much improved vehicle over the Mitsubishi design predecessor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I read an article that said words to the effect of, hey, if you're going to crib from another vehicle, the A student Nissan Rogue is a good one too. So I think the inherent goodness of that Nissan Rogue is going to carry over. And maybe there will be the third row seat is a selling point. And I'm not particularly a fan of that in-your-face Mitsubishi styling, but some people might be. It certainly looks like nothing else on the road. Mm-hmm. The basic product should be good enough. The other concern I have is to the extent that there are still Mitsubishi loyalists, are they going to feel that this new Outlander isn't Mitsubishi enough?
Well, that's a great question because this is the right product for them. If they were going to do something in some segment that was going to save the brand in the United States, a compact crossover is exactly right. And as you mentioned, if you're going to crib from one, why not crib from one of the best? So, I mean, this is the right move. I'm just a little pessimistic about whether or not it matters.
Yeah, there could be a value equation with it as well, but yeah.
Yeah, there could be. It's interesting too because Mitsubishi got itself into a very weird position. If you discount the Mirage, and you should, which is a subcompact car that's very, very unpleasant to drive, they sold three vehicles: the Outlander Sport, and the Eclipse Cross, and they were so close in size and price that it wasn't as if they sold three products. The base price range on those doesn't differ by more than $2,000. So I don't know who it is that goes to Mitsubishi dealers anymore, but I think they're going to have a hard time getting people in there. But if they do, it's probably a vehicle worth knowing about. All right, you know what? We should take a break. When we come back, we talk to John Beal of Collectible Automobile Magazine about what's going on in the April issue. Stick around. You don't want to miss this conversation.
welcome back to the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast, and I am Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Hey, thanks for sticking around. This is the part of the show when I strongly recommend that you follow me on Twitter. I am Car Guy Tom. That is car_guy_Tom on Twitter. I promise to entertain you. All right. He is the award-winning editor-in-chief of the best old car magazine you can buy today. He is also part of the new car evaluation team here at Consumer Guide, and he's sitting in the office right next to mine. Welcome to the show, John Beal.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you guys, or talk to you guys at least.
Whichever.
Hello, Jill. Hello, Damon.
Hello. I just have to say, I find it really funny that you guys are literally sitting right next to each other right now. With a wall between you.
things being what they are, you know, we need to keep our distance, sort of.
Does Tom ever attempt to pass you notes through the ceiling tiles?
No.
You guys could have some kind of real clubhouse secret code situation.
Yeah, just like, I hear stuff going on in that. What's going on up there?
There's some piece of twine dangling a folded up piece of paper.
Here's the thing, though. Once something has happened for 18 years, it's just not that funny anymore.
No.
Oh man! So John, you have this map.
Kill people on that kind of thing used to kill people on the old Mission Impossible. People crawling.
So John, you put together a little magazine called Collectible Automobile. It, to my eyes, looks like a fine magazine. But why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it's our bi-monthly automotive history magazine that's been coming out since 1984. 96 pages every issue, fantastic color photography, great authoritative writers who fill up the spaces in between the pictures, and just wonderful stuff. A lot of the cars that people like, and a lot of ones that they remember well, and maybe a few that they don't.
There is some fantastic photography in this episode. I am looking right now at a picture of the 1963 Ford Falcon Club Wagon, which doesn't sound like it, but it's a van, and it is so cool looking in blue and white.
Oh yeah, I remember those great old, that Econoline series, the passenger van. They were everywhere, and we found a really nice one. And shot it some time ago, and finally had a chance to run it. So we're happy about that in our collectible commercial section.
If I ever knew that the Econoline vans were called Falcon at one point, I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was Falcon. Yeah, it was the Club Wagons. Yeah, mm-hmm. And the Deluxe Club Wagon. And they maintained that name for quite a while, and then they dropped it, and they became known as Club Wagons by the late '60s or so. But they originally were tied because a lot of the mechanicals in those vehicles were similar to the things that were the engines and things were the same engine that was developed for the Falcon when the Falcon first came out in 1960. And so there was a lot of shared stuff in there, and so they tried to tie it to the Falcon.
Yeah. It's funny how things that were once ubiquitous, like delivery vans, or actually the Volkswagen Beetle too, that we saw them everywhere once. They were common as heck, and now we never see them, and we finally appreciate them.
Well, yeah. Well, the song says you don't know what you've got till it's gone. So
I guess so.
And speaking of this Econoline, and speaking of Volkswagens, these cab over engine van styles. Modern-day front collision standards mean that we will not see vehicles of this type, because I would not want to be in a front-end collision with this, because my knees would not – no one's knees would survive, because you are literally – there is no hood. This windshield is right aft of the nose, and you're basically sitting next to the engine instead of being behind it. So, yes, modern-day collision standards mean that – these old-style cab-over-engine vans, this Ford Econoline, Volkswagen Type 2s, not going to see their like again. They sure look cool.
Things got real in a hurry with those up front there.
So, John, tell us about the new issue. Right now, on newsstands, we can find the April issue of Collectible Automobile.
Correct, correct. The April issue is one that we're aggressively selling right now. And so we had our usual complement of four main feature stories. We've done one on the 1980-83 Lincoln Continental Mark VIs. We'll put a little luxury in the personal luxury market there. And then we went way back to the to an early day car. We did the story of the 27 to 1930 Chryslers, which were sort of like the second generation Chryslers after the originals had been launched a few years earlier. We also did an article on the Porsche 914, the somewhat neglected, somewhat scorned, but increasingly more popular coalition between Volkswagen and Porsche. And then we did a really fun photo caption feature on just a dig through our archives to show a lot of styling photography from Chevys from the 1950s. It's great stuff to see what might have happened, what they were thinking of, versus what actually came out. And then we've also got a great profile of an automotive pioneer, Charles Nash, who founded the Nash Motor Company, but was also in the auto industry. Started out at Buick in the teens when General Motors was still in its early years, and from there he took what he learned there and went into business for himself, had a long, wonderful career and made a good go of it. And then our usual departments, and we were just talking about the van, the collectible commercial vehicle, things like that. So we've got a great lineup of wonderful, beautiful things to see, well photographed in this issue.
So about the Lincoln Mark VI, for people who don't know, the Mark series was always sort of premium to the, not always, but for most of Lincoln's recent history, mm-hmm. the Mark series was premium to the Continental series. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was their personal luxury car, their sort of individualized car. It was always, except for this generation, was always a two-door car. But the Sixes actually was the only one where they for a few years, they added a four-door sedan, which and eventually became, and actually by the latter, this was a four-year series run, it edged out and became the more popular of the two. It actually, even the people had associated with the Marks with the two, kind of a deluxe, kind of custom-bodied two-door, the four-door sedan actually started to surpass it in popularity by the end of the run.
One of my favorite things in all of automotive history, and I kid you not, I love branding, I love co-branding, I love weirdness like that, and I love when designers assign their names to something. The Lincoln Mark VI, like the Mark V before it, was involved in one of the greatest co-branding schemes ever in the history of automotive marketing.
Okay.
Tell us about that.
Well, they were actually dating back already even to the Mark IVs of the early to mid 70s.
Okay.
They even started that as early as the Mark IV. They would contract with noted fashion designers to sort of do a decor package. And they would select colors, select fabrics, and then they would market the heck out of these things as there were the Bill Blass marks, there was an Emilio Pucci mark, there was a Givenchy mark, and then there was also the jeweler Cartier did a treatment on it. And this program was incredibly successful. In fact, for a lot of people that's their, who remember those cars, that's their image, is one of those really colorful, specially appointed Mark models. And this series was just steeped in that throughout.
Yeah.
One reason why people want to pick up this issue, if not for anything else, is this incredible brochure art, which features these designers or drawings of these designers with their cars.
Mm-hmm. And
like the Bill Blass picture is so great because it's got a pair of Bill Blass cufflinks in it. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm just going to call out Bill Blass for being the tackiest of the designers. that two-toed treatment seems like maybe someone should have told Bill to back off a little bit.
And yet I think that thing did very well. the blasted. That was the one that had the simulated convertible top. That it was a look that people liked in the 80s, and it was kind of well copied. There were a lot of other cars that had that look at that time too, and into the 80s. So yeah, you can. You know, you can say it's overdone all you want, but it rang the cash register.
Yeah, that's what sold at the time. Actually, you know, yeah. I have to admit, I've never really gave much thought to this generation of Continental, but after reading this article, there's really a lot of interesting things going on here because the 80 to 83 Continentals were the first of the downsized. Because the previous generation, which as the article states, the previous generation were gigantic vehicles, that full kind of 70s Luxo boat style. They sold like gangbusters, but the reality of fuel economy, CAFE standards, what have you, made it clear that Ford was going to need, or Lincoln was going to need to downsize. But they didn't want to stray from the styling of those gigantic Mark V predecessors. So all the design cues, the upright chrome grille, the hidden headlights, the razor sharp beltline crease, all that stuff carried over intact. And in when you look at this generation, this is kind of the last, to my eyes anyway, the last of the Continentals that fully embraced that neoclassic all those neoclassic cues, like the half final tops and the fake convertible tops on one, the overstuffed velour interior, the white wall tires, the fake or real wire wheels, the stand-up hood ornaments, these formal, dimensions, opera windows, all that stuff, very much in that neoclassical vein. But when you look at what European luxury makes were doing, it was much more modern. And the generation of Continentals that followed these really moved away from all that neoclassic gingerbread to a more European look. So an interesting time.
The Mark VII is very much, the Mark VII that came along in 84 was very much, absolutely, very much what you're talking about there. But it's true. This is that look that they sort of established with the Mark III that came out middle of 1968. And this, you know, as the generations grew and they added these various, you know, little Phillips, like things like adding the designer series cars. Those were, that was absolutely plugged into Ford's thinking at that, Ford Motor Company's thinking at that time about, you know, what constituted, you know, luxury and what people would buy, you know, accept as a premium car. And these were cars that were kind of created under the tenure of Lee Iacocca, who liked that kind of stuff. You know, he mm-hmm. thought it was always, if he could pack more things on, he was building more value in there that people would go for. That was the themes that he was always trying to establish. Sometimes, you know, there were certain designers who really, you know, didn't like that. They thought that was the wrong way to go. You'll always find, you know, in a design profession, you'll always find, people who have a different opinion than the boss. But it definitely, certainly with the Mark V's before this, it really, I mean, those were the three best in the entire history of any of the cars that were called Mark whatever number. The Mark V's, the 77, 78, and 79 were the three best selling marks ever by a wide, by a good solid majority.
Right.
Also, John, we have to address something else. So we talked about the designer thing, which of course I'm fascinated by. But
you're all over that one.
Yeah. But the Mark VI has another thing going for it that is extremely bizarre, and I need you to explain it to me. Versions of the Mark VI came equipped with round headlights that were fake, and they were on lids that would fold up to reveal the actual headlights. What the heck was that about?
Yeah, this was a kind of like a driving light, kind of a, you know, and kind of a fog-like thing. They absolutely, yeah, they could not take the place of a headlight. They were not to be used as a headlight. So they would not be on in a normal headlight time. But yeah, it's, and you'll see, we have a photo of a kind of a group shot early in the story of the 70 or the 80 group when they came out with a classic Mark II from the 50s kind of floating in the background, and the coupe in front has those road lights, and it's a bizarre thing to see.
Yeah, because the headlights are literally hidden by headlights.
Yeah,
right. And the hidden headlight the hidden headlight was an absolute signature Mark touch, you know, from the Mark III's on, and you know, Mark III's through the Mark VI's, and yet here actually you put a light over the cover for the real lights.
I don't know that I've ever seen a Mark VI so equipped in real life. I can't imagine that there were many takers for that option. But interestingly enough, in a way, it's kind of ahead of its time, because now every new vehicle has driving lights. They're mandated. So
DRLs, yeah.
Yeah, DRLs. Mm-hmm. They're, of course, like LED now, but... Yeah.
Well, John, we ran out of time here, but I wanted to talk just a little bit about the Porsche 914, because I don't know that everyone knows that story. It was called a Porsche in the U.S., but wasn't it sold as a Volkswagen in other markets?
It was the Porsche Volkswagen. They sort of shared top billing, because it was no secret that they had kind of collaborated on it. It was the body design came from Porsche. The engines for the four-cylinder version came from Volkswagen. And Volkswagen arranged to have with Karmann, the coach builder, to have them built. And then there was a six-cylinder version that had a Porsche 911 engine, a six-cylinder engine, a two-liter engine in the back. And when they sold them here, though, they thought that the cachet of being able to call this a Porsche was paramount. So they were sold. They insisted on selling them exclusive, whether it was four cylinder or six cylinder. They insisted on selling them as Porsches in the United States.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. I understand the controversy about the car's heritage, but I've never understood why people thought this car was that the styling was controversial. I actually think it's great looking.
Yeah, I mean, there were cars of its ilk around that time too. There was, you know, you had the Fiat X19. It sort of had this sort of kind of Targa band roof too, and kind of similar dimensions, and you know, so you could almost think of a later thing would be like a Toyota MR2 kind of has that, you know, that look and that vibe about it too. Our story sort of takes the attitude, you know, the opening line is you know, the opening of the deck that sort of summarizes it is, you know, could this car find, you know, could a car that was part Volkswagen and part Porsche find love in a world that had definite ideas about what both were supposed to be?
Right.
You know, and if you were, you know, in some people's eyes, I think it was neither fish nor fowl, and, you know, but it, they're kind of coming up now, and from, you know, our value guide columnist is pointing out that they're making in the back of the magazine in our value guide section is making a point that they are finding some acceptance and finding a home, and collectors are kind of slowly but surely kind of discovering them.
As they should. John, another fine magazine. How can people interested in subscribing find out more about CA?
Well, they can reach us at our website, www.collectibleautomobile.com.
John, thank you for your time today. We have to have you back on in, what is it, 9 weeks?
If that works for you, Tom, I'm here. You know where I live, right?
Pass a note through the tile ceiling.
We've already established that. You know where I live.
All right. That was John Beale with Collectible Automobile Magazine. Check that magazine out, and it makes an absolutely fantastic gift for the car lovers in your life. Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, it's quiz time. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast, and I am Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and I am tickled to death that you have stuck around for the rest of the show. Hey, Jill.
Hey, what?
Jill, you're active on Party Flock. How can the kids follow you there?
Party Flock, because I like to party, and people flock to me. No. Neither of those things are true. No, and I'm not on Party Flock. I am on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and you can find me at Jill Simonello, just my first and last name. Or I'm going to say you can find me also using the hashtag car du jour, so kind of like soup du jour, but putting car in front. I hashtag everything with that.
Sounds good. Hey, Damon, you're a social media guy. I don't want to risk saying that.
I was going to say, a little lip, you would have been in big trouble hovering over the bleep button.
So, Damon, what's the deal?
Sorry, I'm just imagining the Party Flock logo, and I'm seeing a stylized pink flamingo somehow.
Oh,
pink
I like
flamingo
that.
Is kind of a party bird, isn't it? Party-looking yeah. bird.
For the record, Party Flock is a real social media site.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Hmm.
So we can find the logo later. Damon, check it out and report back.
Okay, I will do that. Or maybe like a cockatiel, the white bird that has like the a little like yellowish tuft on the thing. There's lots of toucans. I'm just realizing there's all kinds of like party-ish looking birds. Most of them tropical.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm on Twitter at Damon Bell Likes Cars.
Sounds good. All right, kids. You know, last week there was some controversy about whether or not the quiz was fair. And Twitter follower James, who's been listening to all our podcasts, suggested that the quiz slow down a little bit after the controversy. So to speed things up a little bit this week and perhaps to make it more fair, we're going back to the old format. I hope you guys are ready.
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. This week's quiz is
Sorry, I listened to last week's show. I think it's a dead heat on the buzz in question.
Okay. Well, then I still kind of blew it.
We needed a tie buzzer.
Yeah, we don't have the something. We don't have the technology when doing it remotely.
No.
That's too much work.
Yeah.
Frankly, I'm not up to it. All right. This week's quiz is titled Foreign Intervention. Are you guys ready?
Ooh, this could be interesting.
Foreign intervention.
Okay.
Jill, you go first this week. Jill, this international automaker recently took a significant 10% stake in Daimler AG, the parent company of Mercedes-Benz. Oh. Was that company Geely, the Chinese parent company of Volvo, or Tata, the Indian-based parent company of Jaguar Land Rover?
Oh, that's a tough one. Because I did not hear this news. Okay. I'm trying to reason my way through it. there was no reasoning my way through it. Because Tata, as you said, was Jaguar Land Rover.
Yep.
Geely has, they do work with Volvo, right?
What's that? Geely basically owns Volvo now.
Yeah, so both luxury, as is Daimler. Yeah, no, there's no more reasoning my way through it. I didn't hear it, so it's just a guess. I'm going to go Geely. They seem to be taking over the world.
By the way, it's Geely. I keep saying it wrong. It's Geely.
Okay, Geely.
Yeah, it's my fault. Damon, same question to you.
Man, I'm at the same loss as Jill. I feel like I saw something in the news about this, but now I can't remember. So just to make it interesting and make it so only one of us has a point, I will say Tata.
Well, by making it interesting, you cost yourself a point, Damon. Jill is on the board. Geely recently took a 9.6% stake in Daimler and has seats on that company's board. Interesting.
Now, Tom, I thought you said this was going to be an easy quiz this week.
I did not say that.
I don't remember him saying that.
I think he actually said just the opposite. So, okay.
I did not say that. All right, Damon, this one's easier. Introduced for 1959, the all-electric Henny Kilowatt small sedan failed to catch on with American shoppers. All told, roughly 30 examples were sold over the car's three-year run. What French car was the Kilowatt and an electric conversion of? Was it the Renault Dauphine or the Peugeot 403?
I just have to say, Henny Kilowatt sounds like the electric company mascot. It's like an anthropomorphic light bulb.
Hey, it sounds like a comedian to me.
Hey, kids, it's Henny Kilowatt. Turn off the lights.
Kind of like the Microsoft little light bulb?
Yeah, or the paperclip or whatever.
Oh,
yeah.
You don't think Henny Kilowatt sounds like a comedian?
Well, there's Henny Youngman.
Henny, or hey, waiter, there's a light bulb in my soup.
Was that his? Was Henny Youngman? Was that his bit?
Probably.
Take my wife, please.
Please.
All right, I'm slamming on the brakes again, and I will say, not the Peugeot, but what was the other? I will say the Renault Dauphine. That was based on the Renault Dauphine.
Jill, would you like me to repeat the question?
No, because I still don't know the answer. So I'll say it was the Peugeot, because I think in French, Dauphine might be dolphin, and that doesn't make sense to me. So I'm going to go with a numbered one, Peugeot.
I think a dolphin is an heir to a throne, and it is also the car that was converted to the Henny Kilowatt. So Damon is on the board with a point.
Okay.
We are tied 1-1. We go to question 3. Okay. Hey, Jill.
Yes.
Jill, most folks probably don't realize what a large company Volkswagen is. The Volkswagen Group brand portfolio currently includes 10 consumer product brands. Which of the following is not one of them? Dacia, Ducati, Seat, or Skoda?
Okay, can you read the question again?
Sure. Which of the following is not part of the Volkswagen brand portfolio?
Okay.
Dacia, Ducati, Seat, or Skoda?
Oh. So I'm familiar with 3 out of 4 of those. I've never heard of the first one. So I'm gonna go with that one. What was that one again? The first
Dacia.
Dacia. I have no idea what that is, so I'm going with that.
That is D-A-C-I.
D-A-C-I. Okay, that looks familiar in my head, but still,
is it
I'm going to...
D-A-C-I or D-A-C-I-A?
D-A-C-I-A.
What did I say? It's D-A-C-I-A, Damon. You're correct.
Yeah, you forgot the A on the end. Okay.
I'm always doing that.
Boy, I know that Ducati is an Italian motorcycle maker, so that's be the odd brand out, but... Things are so weird now, and there's so much cross-pollination that I can't remember if Volkswagen does own Ducati nowadays. I think I'm going to go with Ducati just to be interesting, and then again, we will not have a... because my part of me wants to say Dacia as well, but I think I'm going to go with Ducati.
No, I think Ducati is a good answer.
But you didn't go with it.
I did not go with it, but it is a good answer.
Do you think it's a good answer because I'm wrong?
No, I think your logic was good about it being the motorcycle and Italian. I mean, not that makes much of a difference, but yeah, I think it was a good answer.
Okay. Well, Dacia was the correct answer. Dacia is actually it's part of the Renault-Nissan alliance. Here's a fun fact. Headquartered in Romania, Dacia became part of Renault in 1999. You want another fun fact? VW sells cars in China under the Jetta brand. That is a brand of vehicles in China.
That is interesting.
The score is 2-1 in favor of Jill. We go to the fourth question. Damon, which of the following companies is not a subsidiary of Toyota? Are you ready?
Sure.
Daihatsu, Hino, Lexus, or Suzuki?
It's either Daihatsu or Suzuki. Did they absorb Suzuki in some fashion? Man, this is a tough one.
Suzuki's heritage is a tough one. That's something you can bounce around.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to get burned the same way I did on the Dacia question, but I'm going to say Suzuki.
All right. Jill, same question to you. Which of the following companies is not a subsidiary of Toyota? Daihatsu, Hino, Lexus, or Suzuki?
I actually am going to agree with Damon this time. I think it's got to be Suzuki.
You guys are correct. Suzuki is not part of Toyota. VW briefly owned a 20% stake in Suzuki. You guys might remember that. And it was very ugly.
Yeah.
But Suzuki is largely independent now, although it has a joint venture in India, Maruti Suzuki, which is the largest car maker in India. So there you go. All right, it stays 3-1. We go to the last question. Jill, which of the following is not part of Ford's Brazilian market lineup?
I think it's 3-2. We both got that last one right.
Oh, is it? Okay, you're right. It's 3-2.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
So Damon could tie this up.
Damon can with this question. Yeah. All right. Jill, which of the following is not part of Ford's Brazilian market lineup? Is it Fusion, Ka, Mustang, or Territory?
Brazilian. So Ka, Mustang, or Territory? And that was the Fusion. Good grief. I'd like to think that Mustang is everywhere. I'm going to go with Territory.
All right. Same question to you, Damon.
Boy, that is... I don't know if Ford called the Territory, but there probably could be. And I agree with Jill 100% that I would like to think the Mustang is everywhere, but is it?
That could be the obvious answer.
Yeah. I know Brazil was, the Maverick was sold in Brazil and beloved in Brazil. Mm. Obviously, a Maverick is not a Mustang. I'm going to go with that odd counter logic dark horse pick, and I'm going to say Mustang. Though I'm kind of wondering about Fusion too, but I'm going to say Mustang.
Well, you guys are both wrong. The car, the vehicle not sold in Brazil is the Fusion. There is no sedan in the current Ford Brazilian markup lineup. The Ka, of course, is a subcompact car very popular in Europe, and the Territory is a midsize crossover that Ford imports from China. So, Jill, you've won this week, 3-2. Yeah. We go to the bonus question for no apparent reason except that I wrote it. Are you guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
Don't kiss a guy in a Christmas sweater.
No, that's got nothing to do with this one. Actually, it kind of does. Damon.
Whoa.
Damon, finally, according to IMDb, which of the following Adam Sandler movies has the lower meta score? The meta being a composite score of published reviews of a given film. Meta scores run from 1 to 100. Casablanca, for example, has a meta score of 100, which seems low because it's a perfect movie. Damon, are you ready?
Isn't 100 a perfect score, though?
It is, yes. I'm just a big Casablanca.
It's 111.
Okay.
All right.
Tom,
the water... Go ahead.
Is Little Nicky on your list?
It's not.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, all right. You need to find the lowest rated film on this list according to IMDb. The Waterboy, Grown Ups, Grown Ups 2, or Pixels?
Pixels. Ooh. I vaguely recall Grown Ups being like some sort of Netflix thing. And I think that got pretty bad reviews. But Pixels, I remember seeing a poster for it. That's some kind of animated movie.
It was some weird living in a video game movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I remember seeing a poster for it or something, and then nothing else about it means it kind of tanked.
I think Mini had a product placement in it.
In Pixels?
Yeah.
But it was an animated movie, right?
No, it's not. It's live action.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I remember the grown-ups ones not being well received. I'm just going to take a shot in the dark and say grown-ups 2.
Grown-ups 2. Jill, same question to you. Worst reviews, The Waterboy, grown-ups, grown-ups 2, or Pixels?
Yeah. First, I want to say, has any Adam Sandler movie ever been well received?
Punch Drunk Love is fantastic. Highly recommend Punch Drunk Love.
There you go.
Okay. Great movie. Okay.
But yeah, we're here to make fun of Adam Sandler today.
Yeah. Because my gut would be to say Grown Ups 2 as well, because what sequel ever does well? Unless you're looking at the Harry Potter series. So I don't want to be the same. I'll go with Pixels because I've never heard of it, frankly.
All right, here you go. The meta score again. Casablanca had a score of 100, Waterboy 41, Grown Ups 30, Grown Ups 2, 19, Ooh. Pixels 27. So the correct answer was Grown Ups 2.
Yeah.
So Damon gets the bonus point. The score is 3-2. Jill, an autographed copy of the quiz is in the mail.
My first one of the year, by the way.
I technically tied it up, but it's too late. It's just the bonus. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, the bonus is only for breaking ties.
Yes, that's right.
Damon, we've got like 3 minutes left. Anything you can tell us about what's going on at the TG Daily Drive blog?
Got some great stuff once again. Probably the biggest new vehicle reveal this past week, which we've got a first look on, is the redesigned for 2022 Chevrolet Bolt EV. Mm. And the Bolt EV also gets a SUV-esque sibling called the Bolt EUV. So we've got a first look with the details that Chevrolet has released on that. Neither one of those vehicles is a from-the-ground-up radical redesign. The powertrain basically carries over. The styling is freshened. And then the EUV is essentially a stretched version of the Bolt EV. And they're trying to kind of position it as an SUV, but it's even their own press materials say SUV-esque. But nevertheless, the Bolt EUV gets more rear seat space. Surprisingly, though, not more cargo volume, but that extra rear seat space is probably would make it palatable for a wider number of shoppers. So that's the main thing on the blog this week.
All right, sounds good. People can check out our blog simply by going to consumerguide.com and clicking on the blog tab. It's that easy. Kids, we're out of time.
Again.
Aww. Again. We run out of time every week. But thank you all very much. Special good well wishes to Stan Milam, host of the excellent Stan Milam Show, heard on WCLO Radio in Janesville, Wisconsin. Stan is a listener of the podcast, and he's graciously made me a regular part of his show. Stan is recovering from COVID, and we wish him the best. And remember, you can reach us at carstuff@consumerguide.com. Let us know what you think of the show or what you'd like us to talk about. We will probably ignore your suggestions, but we'd like to hear them anyway.
Okay.
Thanks to our guest today, John Beal of Collectible Automobile Magazine. Thanks, as always, to Jill and Damon. Our heartfelt gratitude to producer Lady B and the good folks here at WCPT AM 820 in Chicago. A special nod to my radio mentor, Steve and Johnny. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. Let's talk some more about cars again next week.